9. The Expulsion of the British. Toussaint sent a white man, Colonel Vincent, an officer of engineers and a close friend, to the Directory to explain his action against Sontenax. Rigaud congratulated Toussaint on the expulsion of Sontenax, and Toussaint, in undisputed command, prepared to sweep the British completely out of San Domingo. Pitt and Dundas for years hung grimly onto their hope of getting the island. In November 1795, in an attempt most probably to win Rigaud, Dundas authorized Forbes to grant the same privileges to mulattoes as to whites. But he still forbade the promise of freedom to Negro troops. That would have been selling the horse to preserve the stable. But the attempt to win Rigaud failed. On February 18, 1796, Dundas addressed the House of Commons. He was speaking in opposition to a motion for the abolition of slavery and the slave trade. In principle, Dundas agreed with the movers of the motion. This agreement, in principle, was routine, but, continues Dundas, with those who argued on the general principle of the slave trade as inexpedient, impolitic, and incompatible with the justice and humanity of the British Constitution, he had always and must still agree. He opposed it because he thought, were it agreed to by the House, it would endanger the peace of the country. Such a resolution, if passed into a law in the present distracted state of the colonies, would throw them entirely into the power of the enemy. The foolish Barnave had not learned to argue that slavery was maintained for the benefit of the slaves. Dundas went even further. The war in the West Indies on the part of this country was not a war for riches or local aggrandizement, but a war for security. But the drain of men and money was too great. By the end of 1796, after 3 years of war, the British had lost in the West Indies 80,000 soldiers, including 40,000 actually dead, the latter number exceeding the total losses of Wellington's army from death, discharges, desertion, and all causes from the beginning to the end of the Peninsular War. The cost in San Domingo alone had been £300,000 in 1794, £800,000 in 1795, £2,600,000 in 1796, and in January 1797 alone, it was more than £700,000. Early in 1797, the British government decided to withdraw and maintain control only of Mole San Nicolas and the island of Tortuga. Toussaint did not know this, however, and he and Rigaud, close allies since the expulsion of Sontenax, organized the final campaign. In January 1798, he was ready for the decisive attack on Mirabelais, while Beauvais, Rigaud, and La Plume were to attack at different points in the south to prevent the concentration of the British forces. Toussaint, wishing to win back for the colony those white and mulatto proprietors who were living in territory controlled by the English, rigorously forbade all pillage and destruction by his own soldiers, and addressed to the traitors a series of proclamations promising them forgiveness and full rights as French citizens if they would be faithful to the Republic. Always a firm adherent of the rules of civilized warfare, he found it necessary to rebuke General John White for the barbarities of the troops under his command. "I feel that though I am a Negro, though I have not received as fine an education as you and the officers of His Britannic Majesty, I feel, I say, that such infamy on my part would reflect on my country and tarnish its glory." Combining military superiority with propaganda, Toussaint won 7 victories in 7 days. Maitland saw that the game was up and asked Toussaint for a truce. He would evacuate the West Province completely in return for the protection of the lives and property of the inhabitants under British rule. That was exactly what Toussaint wanted. And negotiations were already taking place when Toussaint learned that General Edouville had arrived in Spanish San Domingo, appointed sole agent for the colony by the Directory. The five men who, under the name of the Directory, ruled France had been seriously perturbed by the arrival in France of the deported Sontenacs. They never wished to restore slavery, and had warmly approved of the steps Sontenacs had taken to educate the black laborers. But the émigré colonists gave them no rest. And in July 1797, after the Houses had voted for the recall of Sontenacs, they appointed General Edouville their special agent in San Domingo. Edouville, an experienced soldier, had shown notable diplomatic gifts in his pacification of La Vendée, the most dangerous and persistent center of counter-revolution in France. The events which preceded 18 Fructidor had left the directors very much occupied, and those events themselves had sent the most obstreperous of the colonists to Guyana. Had Sontenacs arrived in France before Vaublanc and his friends had been deported, he would have been lucky to escape imprisonment. But once again, he reached home just after the fall of his enemies and met with a sympathetic reception. The directors themselves, however, were now thoroughly alarmed. Toussaint had deposed their representative. There were charges and countercharges of plots for independence. Then came Toussaint's letter warning them that the blacks would fight to the death at any hint of restoring the old regime. Here was a new complication. It was now not so much the mulattoes who were to be feared, but the blacks, their black army, and this black general. At once the attitude to Rigaud changed. Edouville was instructed to leave and to do all that he could to check Toussaint's power until France could send troops. He might have to use Rigaud against Toussaint. The Directory did not know. So it gave Edouville a free hand to pardon or arrest Rigaud as might seem suitable and possible to him. The Directory pretended willingly to accept Toussaint's deportation of Sontenacs and maintained good relations with him. Yet so doubtful was Edouville of the reception he would get from Toussaint that he landed at Santo Domingo, the headquarters of Rome. He arrived late in April, just in time to hear of the further successes of the irresistible Negro. Edouville had gathered from all sources information about the men he was going to meet, and particularly about Toussaint. And nobody left him in any doubt about the kind of man Toussaint was. General Kerverso, an able soldier of strong and upright character, indicated to him the only possible line of policy. "He is a man of great good sense, whose attachment to France cannot be doubted, whose religion guarantees morality, whose firmness equals his prudence, who enjoys the confidence of all colors, and who has on his own an ascendancy which nothing can counterbalance. With him, you can do all. Without him, you can do nothing." It is important for us to remember two sentences in Kerverso's tribute. First, Toussaint was devoted to France. Secondly, Toussaint, in 1798, after 4 years, had the confidence of whites, mulattoes, and blacks. He had set himself this aim. Despite all provocation, he had fought for it and had achieved complete success. What did Edouville intend to do? Toussaint did not know, but he ordered that Edouville should be welcomed with every distinction. In his letters to the new agent, he was polite but reserved.
"Permit me to make an observation to you as officer of the Republic. There are men who appear outwardly to love liberty for all, but who are inwardly its sworn enemies. What I say is true. I know it from experience."
Toussaint was cold, even in his reference to Rome, a sincere friend of the blacks, as his private correspondence shows.
"If the commissioner Rome esteems me, I reciprocate it in my esteem for him and respect his virtues."
Toussaint trusted none of them. But as soon as he heard that Edouville had arrived, he hastened to let Rigaud know. Though reassured by Pinchinat in Paris, Rigaud did not exactly know what steps Edouville intended to take against him. He asked Toussaint for support against Edouville
and sent him a confidential agent to discuss things he dared not write down. The black leader and the mulatto were in complete solidarity. Continuing his negotiations with Maitland, Toussaint granted an amnesty to all the planters who had submitted to the British, and to all the laborers who had fought for British pay. The only persons accepted were those planters who had actually fought in the British ranks, or those royalists who had come to San Domingo from elsewhere. It was a typical gesture by a man who all his life seemed quite untouched by the ordinary human passion of revenge, and never let anything divert him from his aim, the restoration of San Domingo and the reconciliation of all the inhabitants, white, brown, and black. He submitted the terms of the amnesty to Edouville, who ratified them. Maitland tried to distinguish between Toussaint and Rigaud. Toussaint would have none of it, reminding Maitland that he was Rigaud's superior officer. But he did not press Maitland hard. All he wanted was that he should leave San Domingo. All proposals and counterproposals were sent to Edouville for his approval. And on April 30th, the convention was signed whereby the British entirely evacuated the West Province. The soldier émigrés, de Sors and some others, Vicomte and Chevalier, broke the terms of the amnesty, destroyed cannon and ammunition dumps, killed all the animals, and set plantations on fire. Toussaint's Africans, on the other hand, starving and half-naked, marched into the towns, and such was their discipline that no single act of violence or pillage was committed. So admirable was the conduct of his brother, Paul Louverture, and his troops at La Croix du Bouquet, that a number of citizens of all colors wrote to Toussaint expressing their satisfaction at having such an officer in command of their district. They begged for a visit from Toussaint himself. The entry into Port Republican was a Roman triumph. The black laborers, so long made to understand that they were born to serve, came out to see a black army hailed as the saviors of San Domingo, and the whites hastened to abase themselves before him whom they called their liberator. First came the clergy, with cross and banner and censers of burning incense, and then the erstwhile subjects of His Britannic Majesty. In the middle of the road, a huge triumphal arch had been erected. The richest white women, riding on horseback or in open carriages, escorted by a guard of honor composed of young white Creoles, came out to welcome the commander-in-chief. Young white girls threw over him flowers and garlands. Always a model of politeness, he descended from his horse and thanked them for their kindness. Four of the richest white planters of Cul-de-Sac carried with pride a dais, and others of them bowed at his feet, begging him to ascend. Toussaint could see among them men who had been his most relentless enemies, and indignant and humiliated, he refused.
"A dais and incense," he said, "belong only to God."
That night, the town was illuminated. In all the great houses there was dancing, and 150 sat down to a banquet. Next day, the mayor presented an address praising Toussaint's work as a masterpiece of policy, wisdom, and humanity. Toussaint's reply was characteristic.
"Learn, citizens, to appreciate the glory of your new political status. In acquiring the rights that the Constitution accords to all Frenchmen, do not forget the duties it imposes on you. Be but virtuous, and you will be Frenchmen and good citizens. Work together for the prosperity of San Domingo by the restoration of agriculture, which alone can support a state and assure public well-being. Compare in this respect the conduct of the French government, which has not ceased to protect, with that of the English government, which has destroyed. The appearance of your countryside, which I passed through on my way here, has filled me with grief. Its condition should have convinced you long ago that in joining the English, you had embraced only a chimera. You thought you would gain. You have only lost.
the liberty without license which the laborer will enjoy, the reward which the law accords to his labor, will attach him to the soil he cultivates. The age of fanaticism is over. The reign of law has succeeded to that of anarchy. Wise by experience, the Directory has just sent here a single agent whom it has chosen from among its most trustworthy citizens. The glory which he has justly acquired in Europe, the virtues which characterize him, assure us of happiness. Let us aid him in his important mission by absolute obedience. And while he lays the foundations of the felicity which he meditates, I shall look over your safety, your tranquility, and your happiness, so long as you observe the solemn oaths that you have made to remain faithful to France, to cherish its constitution and respect its laws. Man of action, Toussaint habitually wrote and spoke like a philosopher. This comprehensive and concise speech was a program for the country and a personal gesture to Hédouville. Before Toussaint could reach Le Cap, the British, still eager to possess a portion at least of this wonderful island, suddenly opened a strong attack on Rigaud in the south. For the moment, Rigaud was in danger, and he appealed to Toussaint for help. Before Toussaint's reinforcements arrived, Maitland made an attempt to detach Rigaud from Toussaint. Rigaud replied that he would make war on him to the last extremity. Toussaint interviewed Hédouville at Le Cap, then hurried down to meet Rigaud at Port Republican, and the two men saw each other for the first time. Rigaud, who had long wanted to meet this virtuous man, treated Toussaint with the deference due to the commander-in-chief. And Toussaint, who always had perfect tact, addressed Rigaud as his old comrade. With the help of Toussaint's reinforcements, the British attack had been beaten off, and the two set off in Toussaint's carriage to meet Hédouville. The tradition, which has all the facts in its favor, is that they reached Le Cap, each agreeing to support the other against any intrigues by the agent of the Directory. What happened at this interview between Hédouville and Rigaud is one of the great tragedies of San Domingo. Hédouville overwhelmed Rigaud with attentions, promised that France would give him proofs of high consideration, bewailed the evils of the colony, told him that the surest way to assuage them was to help him to achieve his secret instructions, the withdrawal of supreme power from Toussaint Louverture. Rigaud seized the chance to put himself right with France and ruined himself, his caste, and his country for a generation. Between the French bourgeoisie and the black laborers, the mulattoes, from August 1791, wavered continuously. Mulatto instability lies not in their blood, but in their intermediate position in society. The pity was that Rigaud, dictator in the South, had not the sense to see that the French would use him against Toussaint and then inevitably turn on him. It is said in San Domingo that Toussaint, whose methods were always oblique, had hidden himself where he could hear the interview between Rigaud and Hédouville. It was not necessary. During this very visit, Hédouville began to show a changed attitude to Toussaint. The captain of the boat which had brought Hédouville told Toussaint how pleased he would be to take him back to France in the same vessel. "Your ship is not big enough for a man like me," said Toussaint. Still another pressed him about this trip to France, how honored and welcome he would be. "I shall go when this," and he touched a shrub in the garden, "is big enough to take me." Toussaint was warning Hédouville and his friends that no liberties were to be taken with him. Full of diplomatic tricks himself, he affected to be extremely impressed by the courtesies Maitland had shown and would show him. Over and over again, he said that the French would never have treated him in this distinguished way. This was not true, and he knew it. Lavaux and Sontenax and the people of Port Republican had showered on him honors and dignities. But Toussaint wanted this to go to Hédouville. He even wrote to Hédouville about Maitland's honors.
hoped that Edouville had no objections to these courtesies being paid to an officer of the Republic. So that, while doing his duty and paying every necessary attention to Edouville, he let him know by direct and indirect means that he was not going to be trifled with, and demanded in his turn the respect and consideration due to his rank. Edouville, conceited and superior, seemed unable to realize that he was dealing with a man who was in command of a victorious army, had the great mass of the people in two provinces behind him, and had nothing to learn from any Frenchman in subtlety and diplomatic finesse. He continued with his baiting of the uneducated old Negro who spoke French so badly. Rigaud had deserted him. Edouville was just waiting his chance to strike at him. But Toussaint continued with his self-imposed mission of driving the British out with the least damage to the colony. Maitland's forces were now concentrated at Mole Saint-Nicolas in the north and at Jeremy in the south. Toussaint, while massing troops to take them by assault if necessary, now brought off one of his most brilliant pieces of diplomatic negotiation. All the whites in the West Indies, quaking at the bad example Toussaint and his blacks were setting, viewed with dismay the idea of Maitland coming to terms with a black, and none more so than the Earl of Balcarres, governor of Jamaica. All through the negotiations, he was petitioning Maitland not to evacuate Mole Saint-Nicolas. But Toussaint wanted to get Mole Saint-Nicolas without bloodshed, and he wanted a trade agreement with America, which he could get only if the British fleet allowed it. So while he negotiated, he sent message after message to the fractious Balcarres, warning him that Jamaica was very near to San Domingo and that he could easily send some blacks across in canoes to burn down the plantations and start a revolt. Balcarres would naturally inform Maitland of this, and Maitland, the soldier, could appreciate these threats. Either the British must conquer Toussaint, or they must conciliate him. And Maitland knew that Toussaint could not be conquered. He therefore informed Toussaint that he wanted to communicate with him on some important subjects. Toussaint left him in no doubt as to what was wanted.
"I hope it is to announce the definitive evacuation of the points that the English still occupy in this portion of the Republic. It would be the only means of stopping or retarding my march. Although Jeremy is so strong, I promise you to upset its fortifications. If it cost me 2,000 men, I shall take it."
On this, Maitland agreed to evacuate Jeremy. Toussaint secured from Edouville authority to carry on these new negotiations and sent his representative to Maitland to treat at first for all the districts except Mole Saint-Nicolas. But Maitland now gave up hope of retaining even that fortress and offered to evacuate San Domingo completely. Toussaint accepted, keeping Edouville scrupulously informed. Toussaint, though carefully polite with Maitland, was at his most masterful. Maitland proposed to him that, as part of the price for evacuation, the fortifications should be dismantled. Toussaint refused and demanded them in the condition in which Maitland had found them.
"I flatter myself that you will adhere to this demand. If not, I shall be constrained to break off negotiations."
Maitland agreed. But Maitland, after sending his envoy to Toussaint, sent another to Edouville to make special arrangements, not for terms of evacuation, but for the actual transfer of Mole Saint-Nicolas. Maitland may or may not have meant mischief. A few days afterwards, without the slightest trouble, a similar instrument was signed for the rendition of the fortress of Tiburon, after the entry of Rigaud's troops into Jeremy. Edouville said afterwards that Maitland did this to excite the jealousy of Toussaint. If so, his own conduct was all the more open to question. He knew that Toussaint was carrying on negotiations for the evacuation of the Mole with Maitland, but anxious to increase his own prestige, he sent a personal representative to the British commander of the fort and issued a proclamation granting an amnesty in the Toussaint manner. But the terms arranged were not satisfactory to Maitland.
he repudiated them and informed Toussaint, who thus learned that Hédouville was carrying on negotiations with the enemy commander-in-chief behind his back. Toussaint, conscious that his own conduct had been faultless, attacked Hédouville without mercy.
"My frankness prevents me, citizen agent, from concealing that I have been sensibly affected by this lack of confidence. In direct contradiction of your authorization, without regard to my position as commander-in-chief of the Army of San Domingo, without reflection, without even thinking it necessary to inform me, you send junior officers to treat, and you give them powers which annul my own. It seems to me, however, that according to military hierarchy, it is I, as first chief of the army, who should have transmitted your orders to junior officers. I would have preferred that you had declared to me openly that you thought me incapable of treating with the English. You would have then saved me from the disagreeable necessity of contracting written agreements and giving my word of honor. General Maitland, in asking to treat with me, has understood the military hierarchy. If he addressed himself to me as commander-in-chief, I recognized in you the representative of the nation, for I have only treated after having demanded your approval. What have I done to merit this mistrust?"
He had Hédouville in a corner, and he did not spare him. But even then, he did not want a breach, and concluded by saying that if only Hédouville would have confidence in him, together they could save the colony and make agriculture prosper. Hédouville blustered, boasted of all the things he had done and the army staffs on which he had worked, said that Toussaint could not teach him his duty. He did not know how dangerous a game he was playing. Had Toussaint been merely an ambitious chief of brigands, France would have lost the colony in August 1798. Even while Hédouville was so thoughtlessly prodding at the man on whose army and influence everything depended, the British, having failed to conquer Toussaint by force of arms, made a supreme effort to get him by that species of lies and deception known as diplomacy. Maitland, a prejudiced Englishman, did not think Toussaint very intelligent. But Maitland had seen that the blacks in San Domingo, now that they had military experience, organization, and leaders, were a match for any European expedition. The French were certain to send an expedition to restore French authority, and a French army would bleed to death in the island. Maitland, therefore, saw it as his business to make Toussaint as strong as possible in order that he might the more thoroughly defeat the French. He invited Toussaint to an interview, embraced him, paid him full military honors, reviewed the troops for him, gave him magnificent gifts in the name of George III, and then proposed to him to make the island independent and rule it as king. He assured him of British protection. A strong squadron of British frigates would be always in his harbors or on his coasts to protect them, and asked in return for the exclusive trade with the island. The Americans also were building up a good trade with San Domingo. Maitland had sent an American envoy to Toussaint, and it was certain that they would come in with the British. Sharp as was the divergence between himself and Hédouville, Toussaint refused. He, like Rigaud, had enough power to sway his supporters to his will. France was powerless, and he would have got all the support and resources he needed from Britain. His refusal is the measure of the difference between himself and Rigaud. The British, he knew, would make the alliance, and then, when he had broken with France, either come to terms at his expense with France, or, with their strong squadron of frigates designed for Toussaint's protection, blockade the island, overthrow him, and restore slavery. Toussaint would have none of it. Maitland's letters show, it is true, that he realized, as so many of the French who knew the island realized, that the Negroes in San Domingo were a power. The British were going to keep their bargain for the sake of British honor, but also because they could not do otherwise. But as soon as peace was declared, it would be a different story. This is not in any way speculative. Before the end of the year, Maitland actually wrote this to Dundas, to be quite sure that the intended treachery should not miscarry. It may not be necessary for me to add that the instant peace takes place, my whole view of this subject would at once be changed.
It was not necessary.
Dundas would understand. To avoid any shadow of misunderstanding, Maitland continued. To diminish the French power and to stop the greater evil of the French Directory getting into its hands the means San Domingo would afford them of annoying us, it may be well to submit to the smaller evil of, during the war, supporting the assumed power of Toussaint. But on the restoration of peace and anything like a settled government in France, both with a view to the restoration of the original colonial system, if that is practicable, and with a view to let France waste her means in men and money in this attempt. It was in the best tradition of the way in which the higher civilization uplifts the backward peoples. But Toussaint merely expressed his regrets and declined with thanks. Such is history. But if that were all, it would be unreadable. Along with the material resistance to Maitland's debased concept of human life and the unashamed savagery of himself and his highly placed instructors, it is to be noted the elevated principles by which the ex-slave guided his profoundly practical life. Toussaint was then, as always, devoted to the French Republic. This devotion will in the end lead him to an untimely and cruel death, but it gave him a splendid life. To all the blacks, revolutionary France, which had decreed equality and the abolition of slavery, was a beacon among the nations. France was to them indeed the mother country. Toussaint, looking always to the development of the blacks as a people, did not want to break with France, its language and tradition and customs, to join the slave-holding British. He would be faithful to France as long as France was faithful to the blacks. But the war prevented France from sending supplies to the colony, and he arranged a secret convention with Maitland whereby goods should come to certain selected ports in British and American ships, to be paid for by San Domingo produce. More he would not do. When Balcarres learned that Maitland was evacuating San Domingo completely, he wrote to the home government protesting. The reply was a masterpiece. After detailing at great length the various advantages of the evacuation, it concluded with unanswerable resignation. There was nothing else to be done. Both on the battlefield and in the council chamber, Toussaint had outmaneuvered the British generals as he had outmaneuvered the Spaniards, getting all that he required at the least possible cost to himself. This was the end of the ill-fated expedition to San Domingo. After long and careful thought and study, says Fortescue, I have come to the conclusion that the West Indian campaigns, both to windward and to leeward, which were the essence of Pitt's military policy, cost England in army and navy little fewer than 100,000 men, about one half of them dead, the remainder permanently unfitted for service. For the sake of a few barren islands still held by the British, England's soldiers had been sacrificed, her treasure squandered, her influence in Europe weakened, her arm, for 6 fateful years, fettered and paralyzed. Fortescue does not seem to realize that Pitt and Dundas were playing for the finest colony in the world and a rich market for the otherwise unprofitable slave trade. Fortescue blames everything and everybody. Pitt and Dundas for incompetence, the climate, the fever. The fever killed many more men than the blacks and mulattoes did. But we have seen with what poor resources and against what internal intrigues Toussaint fought. San Domingo was not the first place where European invaders had met fever. It was the decree of abolition, the bravery of the blacks, and the ability of their leaders that had done it. The great gesture of the French working people towards the black slaves, against their own white ruling class, had helped to save their revolution from reactionary Europe. Held by Toussaint and his raw levies, singing the Marseillaise and the Ça ira, Britain, the most powerful country in Europe, could not attack the revolution in France. The secret of England's impotence for the first 6 years of the war may be said to lie in the two fatal words, Saint-Domingo. Hédouville knew all this. None would know it better than he. But for him, the expulsion of the British was merely another good reason why Toussaint should be got rid of at once. France wanted her authority restored in the colony. That was politics, and there is no gratitude in politics. But Toussaint was a Negro and a former slave. And now that he had won back the colony for them, Hédouville and his staff not only intrigued against him, but grossly insulted him. Toussaint often wore a handkerchief tied round his head, and some of them boasted that with four men, they could go into the camp of the old monkey with the handkerchief and capture him. Not only did Toussaint hear it, but it began gradually to be rumored among the black masses that the agent and his staff were hostile to Toussaint. And whoever was hostile to Toussaint was hostile to the blacks. And yet it is curious and characteristic of Toussaint that the most bitter subject of quarrel was the émigré whites, with Toussaint the ex-slave taking their side, and Hédouville, a former nobleman, attacking Toussaint for protecting them. Roume also recommended conciliation with the émigrés, but he advised the Directory to scrutinize carefully all the planters and allow only those who had rid themselves of their former prejudices to come back to the colony. Toussaint, however, invited back all who would take the oath of fidelity. Perhaps in addition to their valuable knowledge and education, he felt that they would cease to intrigue and plot for the restoration of slavery only if they came back and found it possible to enjoy their property. He needed them now more than ever to counterbalance the power of the mulattoes. Some of these émigrés, commanding Negro troops hired by the British, had been excluded from the original amnesty. But Toussaint knew that Saint-Domingo cultivation needed these blacks, knew too that Maitland was going to take the blacks straight to Jamaica where they would find themselves enslaved. Maitland was prepared to treat for them if their officers were also accepted, and Toussaint agreed. Hédouville accused him of protecting the enemies of the Republic. Toussaint referred to the amnesty authorized by him and the special circumstances of these émigré officers. Toussaint, a sincere Catholic, had pardoned some émigrés who swore fidelity after a church service. Hédouville accused him of breaking the Republican law which forbade official association with religion. The bickering being continuous, Toussaint resigned his post as commander-in-chief. What his feelings were, we can judge from his letter to Hédouville, when the latter refused to pronounce on the resignation. This is, with perhaps one exception, the most astonishing of the voluminous and astonishing correspondence of this uneducated ex-slave, who, until he was 45, 6 years before, had probably never received a letter, far less written one. There was no need for you to quote me your instructions to recall to me your worth and dignity. It is sufficient for me to know that you are sent by France to hold in veneration. I respect too much the Directory of which you are the agent not to respect you in person and covet your approbation. The proofs of confidence with which the Directory has honored me are too precious not to make me desire yours to the same degree. But it is because these sentiments are profoundly engraved in my heart. It is because your esteem and your confidence are infinitely precious to me that, justly alarmed at the fear of losing them, I found it necessary to show you my despair. Faithful to my duty and my principles, I could only attribute the misfortune which has befallen me to the perfidious maneuvers of intriguers against me, personally, and against peace and order. If I have asked permission to retire, it is because, having honorably served my country, having snatched it from the hands of powerful enemies who fought for possession of it, having extinguished the fires of intestine war to which it was for long a prey, having too long forgotten a cherished family to which I have become a stranger,
having neglected my own interests, sacrificed my time and my years to the triumph of liberty. I wish now to save my old age from an insult which would shame my children. I would feel it the more, inasmuch as I shall know that I have not deserved it, and I shall certainly not survive it. I do not conceal from you that, as you seem to be delaying indefinitely to accede to my request, I shall make it to the Directory itself. Men in general are so inclined to envy the glory of others, are so jealous of good which they have not themselves accomplished, that a man often makes himself enemies by the simple fact that he has rendered great service. The French Revolution has furnished many examples of this terrible truth. Many great men have expiated in exile or on the scaffold the services that they have rendered to their country, and it would be imprudent for me to remain any longer exposed to the shafts of calumny and malevolence. An honorable and peaceful retreat in the bosom of my family is my sole ambition. There, as at the head of my armies, I shall always be ready to show a good example and give the best advice. But I have learnt too much of the heart of man not to be certain that it is only in the bosom of my family that I shall find happiness. These words surely came from the heart. Vaublanc and the others being in Guyana, he had no immediate fear of slavery. He saw that Edouville might dismiss him. To resist would have meant civil war, against Rigo also. My conduct for some time, and above all since your interview with General Rigo, has been a continual infraction of the law. And rather than face a civil war purely for his personal position, he preferred to go. Edouville had been rubbing it into him that, though commander-in-chief, he was subordinate to the agent. "I know your powers," wrote Toussaint. "That is why I addressed my resignation to you. And if I had not known them, you would have taught them to me by ceaselessly reminding me that you can dismiss me, which makes me think you very much want to do so." It was no bluff. He sent a secretary to the Directory to arrange the terms of his retirement. The English were not yet 6 months out of San Domingo. Toussaint was drinking the cup to the dregs. But even then, as the letter shows, he was not thinking in any way of the independence of the colony. He would retire. If any attempt were ever made on liberty for all, he would be there. It was the San Domingo masses that saved him. Edouville was making arrangements with the Directory to supersede him and the black generals and put three white generals in their place. But he dared not do it. So great was the unrest in the country and in the army. Edouville tried to introduce a system of apprenticeship of the laborers to the owners for periods of 6 and 9 years, a stupidity which the British were to repeat with a resounding ill success after the emancipation of the slaves in their own colonies in 1833. The blacks might have taken that from Toussaint or Sontenax, not from Edouville. The army had not been paid, despite Toussaint's urgent pleas, and it resented its neglect and the attacks on its general. Fears for black liberty began to grow. Edouville claimed that Toussaint and the generals were spreading calumnies against him among the laborers. He wanted them, like good French citizens, to sit quietly, while now that he had no use for them, he arranged for their dismissal, and once more put black men where they belong. The unrest increased. Edouville began to realize where he would find himself without Toussaint. He asked Toussaint to address a circular to the commandants of the districts to quiet the blacks and turn them from their alleged intention to rise and massacre the whites. Toussaint repudiated this aspersion on the character of the laborers, and while he addressed the required circular, he disassociated himself from the idea that the blacks were only awaiting an opportunity to massacre the whites. Edouville now tried to recover lost ground with Toussaint. He made overtures through friends. Toussaint replied in kind, but held himself stiffly aloof. Edouville wanted to restore the civil authority as the controlling force, and was naturally in immediate conflict with Toussaint's generals. Toussaint had disbanded some of the troops,
They had gone back to work, willingly. But Eduville was disbanding Negro troops and confiding the care of the coasts only to white troops. The blacks looked on this with intense suspicion. Eduville was not Lavaux or Sontenac's. The blacks did not care for anything he had done in La Vendée. He addressed a sharp reprimand to Moïse, unjustly. Moïse replied as sharply. The country was in that state of tension when any incident could cause an insurrection. Toussaint would not go to Le Cap. He told Eduville that he had been informed that his life was not safe there. Eduville asked him to go to Fort Liberté, where Moïse was stationed, to quiet unrest. Toussaint found an excuse for delay. If Eduville wanted to govern, well, let him govern. Suddenly, a private quarrel broke out among the garrison at Fort Liberté while Moïse, the commander, was away. The soldiers, representatives of the laborers, got into conflict with the municipality, consisting chiefly of mulattoes and the old free blacks. A word from Toussaint would have restored order. Instead, Eduville sent another Negro, Monginat, with authority to depose Moïse and assume command. Certainly in law, Eduville had every right to dismiss Moïse. But not only was the action unjustified, it was stupid. For Moïse was, after Toussaint, the most popular man in the army, and was also Toussaint's nephew. Moïse, returning to the fort, found Monginat proclaiming his new commission. "You cannot make war as I can, citizen Monginat," he told him. "Take care." But Monginat, with Eduville's commission, insisted on his rights. The National Guard and a detachment of European troops opened fire. One of Moïse's brothers was killed, the other was captured, and Moïse had to ride for his life. As soon as Eduville heard of this, he dismissed Moïse from the service and ordered that he should be captured, dead or alive. When Toussaint heard that Eduville had dismissed Moïse, he gave Dessalines orders to march on Le Cap and arrest Eduville. Toussaint had given the agent ample rope, and Eduville had hanged himself. At first, he maintained a bold front, but Moïse raised the black laborers on the plain, and as Eduville felt the noose tightening about his neck, he sent Colonel Vincent and a priest to Toussaint, seeking to patch up the quarrel. But Toussaint's mind was now made up, and he acted with his usual rapidity and decision. Intimate as he was with Vincent, he arrested and imprisoned him. He ordered a detachment to intercept three of Eduville's officers who served under Rigaud and were bringing letters. They attempted resistance and were killed. Toussaint then marched on Le Cap. Eduville did not wait for him. Already, Dessalines' troops were pushing into the outskirts of the town. Eduville issued proclamations denouncing Toussaint as a traitor and fled on board a boat in the harbor. Toussaint, arriving in Le Cap, invited Eduville to come ashore, but Eduville declined and left for France, with about 1,000 functionaries, whites, mulattoes, and former free blacks, who detested Toussaint and his ex-slave generals. The municipality and the citizens hastened to welcome Toussaint and thank him for restoring order. The Rubicon had been crossed, and next day in a public speech at Fort Liberté, Toussaint boldly asserted his own authority.
"At the very moment when I have chased the English from the colony, Eduville chooses a Negro to destroy the brave General Moïse and the 5th Regiment who have so much contributed to the evacuation of our enemies from the colony. It is they whom you wished to kill, and when you killed them, do you not know that there are thousands of brave blacks behind you who would have taken vengeance for this brave General Moïse and the 5th Regiment? Don't you see that you expose all these unhappy Europeans and your wives and children to massacre? What would France say? I reinstate Moïse in his former functions. Who reverts to the sword will perish by the sword. Eduville says that I am against liberty, that I want to surrender to the English, that I wish to make myself independent.
Who ought to love liberty more? Toussaint Louverture, slave of Breda? Or General Edouville, former Marquis and Chevalier de Saint-Louis?
If I wished to surrender to the English, would I have chased them away? Remember that there is only one Toussaint Louverture in Saint-Domingo, and that at his name, everybody must tremble.
This was the new Toussaint. He had no wish to break with France, but Edouville, France's representative, had been a source of nothing but unrest and disorder. Henceforth, he would govern. That night, he dined with Moise, and in a long monologue, he expressed himself fully. It is one of the few occasions on which we get a glimpse into his mind.
Edouville has spread it that he is going to France to seek forces to come back. I do not want to fight with France. I have saved this country for her up to the present. But if she comes to attack me, I shall defend myself.
General Edouville does not know that at Jamaica there are in the mountains blacks who have forced the English to make treaties with them?
Well, I am black like them.
I know how to make war, and besides, I have advantages that they didn't have, for I can count on assistance and protection. Toussaint clearly meant the British. But although he knew that the British would leap at the chance to ally themselves with him, he would only form an alliance if the French attacked him.
Finally, he told Moise and the others, I have done what I ought to do. I have nothing to reproach myself with. I laugh at whatever Edouville says, and he can come when he wants to.
There is the same note of personal responsibility as when Sontenac was embarked. He worked alone, making his decisions without the advice or assistance of anyone, and his officers, soldiers, and laborers followed him blindly. Where was he heading for? He did not know. His powerful mind, unaided by precedent or education, was slowly working out a satisfactory relationship with France whereby the connection would be maintained with benefit to both, and yet he would govern, as all these commissioners, agents, and others could not govern. He would find it before long. But meanwhile, he sent Vincent to Rome in Santo Domingo, asking him to assume the position vacated by Edouville until instructions came from Paris. But Rome was already commissioner. When Edouville left France, the Directory was so uncertain of his reception and his future fate that a member of his staff was entrusted with a sealed packet to be opened only in case of his death or enforced absence from the island. When it was opened, it contained Rome's appointment. Rome was therefore installed as Edouville's successor. The faithful Vincent, who thoroughly approved of Edouville's expulsion, was sent to Paris to present Toussaint's dispatches and explanations. In his report, Toussaint accused Edouville of serving the interests of the party which had been defeated on the 18th Fructidor. Over and over again, he referred to this coup d'etat. The machinations of Vaublanc and the émigrés haunted him and the black laborers of San Domingo. Edouville naturally reached Paris before Vincent. From him, the Directory learned that the colony was practically lost to France, and that there was only one chance of saving it. The export of sugar and coffee by English and American boats will make money flow in the colony, and he, Toussaint, will not fail to attribute this state of things to the wisdom of his government. I am no less convinced that sooner or later this precious island will escape from French domination. I do not take it on myself to propose the measure you will take to weaken the power of those who dominate it, but if the moment is not yet ripe for taking vigorous measures, it will perhaps appear to you important to create germs of division between them, to embitter the hate which exists between the mulattoes and the blacks, and to oppose Rigaud to Toussaint. I do not see my way to guarantee the purity of the intentions of the first, but in justice to him, I can assure you that I have only praise for his conduct. You will have proof in his correspondence. If I had been able to count entirely on him, I would not have hesitated to go to the south in spite of the uncertainty of sailing there without being interrupted by the English. Although race feeling remained, there was no hostility between Toussaint and Rigo. Eduville's own words show that he deliberately created it, and even then was not sure of Rigo. Before he laid the plan in front of the directory, he had acted. He had written a letter to Rigo, absolving him from all obedience to Toussaint, and authorizing him to take possession of the districts of Léogon and Jacmel, incorporated in the south by a previous decree not yet carried into effect. That, he hoped, would start the conflagration and keep it going until France was ready. Eduville and his superiors belonged to the same breed as Maitland and his. Uninhibited, they wallowed with zest in the filth and mire of their political conceptions and needs, among the very leaders of their society, but nevertheless the very dregs of human civilization and moral standards. A historian who finds excuses for such conduct by references to the supposed spirit of the times, or by omission, or by silence, shows thereby that his account of events is not to be trusted. Eduville, after all, was a product of the great French Revolution. Voltaire and Rousseau were household words and died before the revolution began. Jefferson, Cobbett, Tom Paine, Clarkson, and Wilberforce had already raised banners and were living lives which, to Maitland and his kind, made them into subversive enemies of society. They had their reasons. So have their counterparts of today. They fill our newspapers and our radios. The type is always with us, and so are their defenders.